warn you. And I'm going to do that by first describing a brief story. I teach philosophy at Stevenson University, Intro to Philosophy. And I introduced the class to pragmatism, philosophical approach to life, mainly an approach to ethics. And I present to them an opportunity to write a paper, and they can choose ethical dilemmas. And one of the ethical dilemmas they can choose is this brief story. You are amongst 20 other people that are of your same faith, and you are climbing the Rocky Mountains, and you get caught in a blizzard, and that blizzard lasts for days to where you run out of food, and you run out of shelter, and you are cold, and you are hungry, and it lasts so long that some of you in your party die. Now, the dilemma is, if you are one on the mountain that is still alive, do you eat the flesh of those who were your companions on this trip in order to stay alive? And the dilemma that, and I actually have another dilemma they can choose from, but that one is usually the one everybody wants to answer. And I also tell them in the dilemma that the faith restrictions and convictions of the group is that cannibalism is a sin. So that's the background of it. And they are to answer what is the right thing to do in that moment, considering pragmatism as an answer, whether negative or positive. And I would say, after teaching that class now for 8 semesters, I would say that 90% of the students argue that it is acceptable for you to choose to eat your companions, your friends, those who were on the trip with you. And their answer is essentially based on the evolutionary theory, survival of the fittest. We need to survive. That's why we exist, in order to survive. And therefore, do what we can to survive, rather than follow our convictions, even if it might lead to death, rather than try to find some other possible way to stay alive. They believe it's right, it's acceptable to eat their fellow man. Now, I always argue with them, and I always wrestle with them, and I always get frustrated with them. And I continually hearken back to this argument that it's part of their religious conviction. And one girl said to me not too long ago, she said to me, after raising her hand, "I have never met anyone that lives by their religious faith like that, that's devoted like that, that they would make a decision based off of their faith." And I was stunned. And all I could say was, "Ouch." She's never met anybody that would make a decision based off of their religious faith. And so we have a problem, do we not, in our culture, certainly on college campuses. Another thing that influenced me to have a weekend like this was a book titled I Am Charlotte Simmons. I Am Charlotte Simmons. Now, I do not want you to read that book. If you do, you have fair warning from me that it is vile. It is perverted. I read it because someone had told me, if you have a burden for college students, then... I'm sorry. You're watching the picture.
I close it. Is that going to be good?
No. If you have a conviction for college students and you're concerned about them, read this book. And so I did. It's written by Tom Wolfe. And it's a novel, but it's based off of a contemporary college student, young girl, who goes to college at a major institution, a well-known institution, on a scholastic scholarship. And she comes from a very impoverished home and a very small town. And so she is ignorant and naive as to what it's like in the big city amongst people who have different morals. And what's interesting is he does this book just after his daughter graduates from Duke. And many critics say this sounds a lot like Duke University that he's describing. He denies it, of course, but you can tell he's done his research. And you can tell he knows what it's like to be on a college campus. He describes this naive girl thinking she's going to have the world at her fingertips in this university to learn all that she wants to learn, come to find out that most of it is games. Most of it, most students are there to enjoy the flesh rather than grow the mind. He describes her going into a co-ed dorm room where the men and the women share a bathroom. And she describes getting cleaned up, ready for the night, and boys coming in. And if you've been around boys in bathrooms, you know how bad it can be. And here she is grossed out by what she experiences. Then she meets her roommate, who's a wealthy young girl who is, without a better description, a slut. And that girl, all she cares about is hooking up with guys. And so it tells about the travails and the troubles. This Charlotte Simmons, she actually ends up having an eye for a fraternity brother who's a big man on campus. She's a pretty girl, but very plain. He thinks that she's one that he can pluck, and so he takes advantage of her. In fact, there's this scene where he's walking her around through the frat house, and as a reader, you're going, no, don't go with him into that room. Don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, because you know what he's after. She does end up being date raped. She ends up being humiliated. She ends up almost dropping out of school. It does have a hope ending to it, and I don't need to give that away. But the pictures that he draws, the lifestyle that is there on college campuses, is disheartening, to say the least. And I was imagining Christian people going to college and seeing all of this, maybe for the first time, but at least being exposed to it to an increased level, to where temptation is all around. And I kept thinking, are we prepared? Are you prepared to face these temptations? The environment of modern college campuses is probably epitomized by what is called the Yale Sex Week. The Yale Sex Week. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. But Yale started in 2002 to have a sex week where they would bring in speakers to talk about all types of perverse ways in which people could express their sexuality. And they would bring in porn stars. They would bring moguls from the porn industry. They would bring in people who were prostitutes. They would bring in, of course, all of the homosexuals, bisexuals, all that, as speakers. And you could go to these different seminars and learn how to be like them. Now, that was very controversial, as you can imagine. Some colleges even tried to duplicate it. Last year, Yale ceased having their sex week because, like everything that is corrupt, it gets more corrupt. And what was happening is these students who were leading it were in the back pockets of the porn industry leaders. They would pay these kids under the table to bring in their speakers, to bring in their toys, to bring in their movies, to highlight what they do. And therefore, these kids were just doing it then now to get a buck, not because they just wanted freedom and sexuality. So corrupt becomes more corrupt. Well, I'm sharing this with you is because when you see a Yale sex week, you recognize that that is one of the last dominoes to fall. And one of the first dominoes to fall is the one that stands and says there is a God. Because if you say there is a God, then you have to deal with the reality of absolute truth and absolute morality. And if there's absolute truth and absolute morality, then you have to make a stand as to how you're going to live and be responsive to that God who exists. But if you knock down that domino and say God does not exist, well, there goes absolute truth. There goes absolute morality, and the result is that you can do whatever you want and not feel guilty about it. Who are the victims of such a thing? Well, the victims, to be frank, are usually the girls, because the guys just want to enjoy themselves, and the girls want relationship, and the only way they can get relationship is to be sexual, so they have to bow to that. The guys get their pleasure, and they move on, and the girls become scarred and heartbroken. And if the guy has any conscience, well, he's going to be scarred as well. But of course, it's not just sexuality. It's many other moral dilemmas that we face as Christians, that if that first domino is doubted at all, if we just, you know, I don't really know if everything that my mom and dad taught me, I don't really know if everything they say at the church is true, and I'm faced with an ethical dilemma here, and I'd really like to do this, but it goes against the idea of what they're telling me about God. Maybe he doesn't, maybe I can't be as confident, and maybe I can do this. And that's what I'm here to try to help you not do. One other story. We went to a wedding in May as a family. Isaac, my third son, was with us, and he stayed with his cousins. They had graduated from a state college. And he said to me as we were walking, he goes, "You know, Dad, so-and-so said to me that," and I'm sorry, I don't quote this exactly right, Isaac, but said to me, "He's really surprised that you teach logic and that you are a pastor, because to him, those two things don't go together." And he gets a little smirk on his face, knowing that he just pushed a button of mine that just sends me to frothing at the mouth, because I do believe that faith and reason go together. Staunchly believe it. Defend it vigorously. And then I started to spout off all the things I would say to him, and Isaac had to hear it. But my point being is that I'm going to try to work with you tonight to start off by showing you that faith and reason go together, that what we believe as Christians is reasonable. And you'll hear that word again and again. And note that my approach tonight is more of a shotgun approach. Anybody ever seen The Birds? Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. Oh, that's so disappointing. It's a small town. A bunch of birds are attacking, and they don't know why, but they're seagulls, and they're going crazy, and every time the people go out or they start pounding at the houses when they try to stay in, they're being attacked by birds. We watched this when I was in college, and my roommates and I got into a debate. Okay, what would you do? Would you use a machine gun to kill them or a shotgun? Because that's really the only two options. Machine gun or a shotgun. And I settled for the shotgun. Double barrel. Get as many pellets out there as you possibly can to kill as many birds as you possibly can, rather than have the opportunity to miss. So that's my approach, shotgun approach. I'm going to hit on a number of different things, see if I can get as many dead tonight as I can. All right. Let's...
We can get this back up.
Here we go. And I'm sorry if this is too small. I thought it would be bigger. I'll read it as well. So hopefully it won't... And I can send these notes out to you as well. So, here we go. The first argument for the existence of God is reason alone. All you need is your mind to know that God exists. This is actually an argument that is given credit to St. Anselm. You'll see that his death, so we're talking the 12th century, I have two sons that attend St. Anselm College, so they've heard this before. Whether they remember it or not, I don't know. The first argument in this reason alone argument for the existence of God, this is also called, for you philosopher types, the ontological argument, argument from being. So, first part of the argument, God is defined as that which nothing greater can be conceived. That which nothing greater can be conceived. Now, consider that definition, and be sure that it's a good one. When we talk about God, we say he is, in his characteristics, he is omniscient, all-knowing. He is omnipotent, all-powerful. And omnipresent everywhere. So we're using universal affirmatives, for those of you who've had logic. Universal affirmatives, to where anything else that comes below that is a particular. Regardless if it almost knows everything, it's still a particular. It's not a universal. So when we talk about God, we define him, we say, if there's anything that can be described that is good and right and just and holy, he is that definition, the highest of definitions. He fulfills it all. So nothing, that which nothing greater can be conceived. That's our definition of God. Then we move on to our point number two. It is possible for things to exist in the mind as well as in reality. It is possible for things to exist in the mind as well as in reality. Does a one-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater exist? Does it?
If it's in your head.
That's right. It exists in your head. You can picture a one-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater. You know that that's a song, right? From the 50s? Look it up on YouTube or something. Maybe Pandora has a station for it. But that exists in our minds. Now, here's something interesting, just as a little extra. Do you know that you can't think of anything that doesn't exist? You can't think of anything that doesn't exist. And I don't just mean that you can't think of it in terms of, it exists in the mind. I mean that everything that you say exists is either what you have experienced or what you combine together. A one-eyed, one-horned, flying pool people eater, that doesn't exist, right? Well, think about what you just conjured up in your mind. You know what a one eye is. You know what a one horn is. You know what flying is. You know what purple is. You know what a people eater is. And you just put those all together. So they already existed. You just mixed them up again. You didn't conjure up anything that didn't exist. That's our minds. Okay, so it is possible for things to exist in the mind as well as reality. Now, Freud would agree with this, because he would say that, oh yes, God exists in the mind because all of us want a father-like figure. We're after that father-like figure, and so we conjure up this idea of God that fits that father that we're all missing, that we all desire. So he would even agree at least with that. The next statement, therefore, A, God exists only in the mind. Okay, things exist in the mind and in reality. God exists only in the mind. Or B, God exists in the mind and in reality. It can only be one of those two things, right? God exists in the mind, or he exists in the mind and he is real. Only those two options. And we go to point number three. If something exists in the mind and in reality, it is greater than anything that exists only in the mind. If I actually brought in here, opened the door, and one-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater came in here, you go, wow, I've never seen one of them before. And that would be better than existing in the mind, would it not? You could experience it. It's tangible. It does something to you because of that experience, whether it be by the eyes, whether it be by the smell, whether it be by all the senses combined, that experience is greater than just in the mind. Okay? So something exists in the mind and in reality is greater than anything that exists just in the mind. Point number four. Because of our definition of God, remember from point number one, he cannot exist only in the mind, for there is something greater still. So God is defined as that which nothing greater can be conceived, and that which can be nothing greater can be conceived has to be both in the mind and in reality. Then we come up with our conclusion, point number five, therefore God exists. Now this is pure reason. There's no experience here giving you examples, but it's based on pure reason. It is what we would call a sound argument. A sound argument is that the conclusion follows from the premises. In fact, a sound argument says that a conclusion follows from the premises because it has to, that makes it valid. And then, when the premises are true, we say it's sound. And the only way that this can be refuted is how? Anybody want to guess? Yes. What's that? Yeah, you challenge your definition of God. But that in itself is an interesting argument. How would you define God? How would you define it differently than that? And of course, philosophers try to, but fail, in my opinion. All right, any questions about argument from reason. Are we good? We're convinced? All right, let's go home. Not enough? Okay, we'll do some more. Next is the argument from contingency. The contingency argument. And you're going to see a number of premises. Those of you who are in syllogistic logic and think that's the only way to reason, sorry, we're not going to be doing a lot of syllogisms. We have several premises here.
The one follow after the other.
All right, the first one. First premise for the argument of contingency. That which exists is caused either by the necessity of its own nature or by an outside agent. That which exists is caused by the necessity of its own nature or by an outside agent. What that implies is the definition of contingency is that one thing existing is dependent upon another thing existing. It's contingent upon it. That's how we would use the word. Dependent upon it, contingent upon it. It needs that which came before it in order for it to exist. And so we say, that which exists is caused either by the necessity of its own nature or by an outside agent. Something in its nature means it has to exist the way it does, or something outside of it caused it to exist the way it exists. Now, let's think about it in this way. Let's say that you were to come in here, you haven't come in here yet, you were to walk in here, and you saw a basketball sitting right here. Right there. And you walk in, and if you're a person, most of the guys will not pay attention to it, guys will go, oh, and then keep going. But if you're a thinking person, you might go, oh, what's that doing here? That doesn't belong in a classroom. And then you might think, well, how did that get here? And then you would go, well, someone must have been working in here and had come up the stairs after playing basketball and forgot their basketball. Or maybe someone was working up here and a little kid came up here bouncing a basketball and forgot the basketball. Maybe there's another reason. But you would think, if you wanted to think about it, how'd that get here? You would say, that basketball is here contingent upon somebody bringing it here for whatever reason. Now, think about it in terms of a large 8-foot sphere that glows, and it's sitting in the middle of the parking lot. You drove up and you see this 8-foot sphere that's glowing, and you're going to say to yourself, you have to, well, how did that get there? Well, somebody had to put it there. How did they do that? What is it? And you're going to go to someone, what is that? Who put that there? What does it mean? You're looking for an understanding because you're knowing that that existence is contingent upon someone putting it there. Now let's say that you grew up in a vacant lot, and it was a large vacant lot, and you're away for a couple of years and you come back and you see that there's a mansion built on this vacant lot. It's huge. 20 rooms, 30 bathrooms, whatever. It's a huge mansion. And you're saying to yourself, how did that get there? Someone must have built that. I wonder who did that. They had a lot of money. Because all that existence of a mansion is contingent upon money and someone building, someone owning. That has to be there. There has to be answers. Now back up. Now let's all sit on the moon. Okay? We're all on the moon. And we look at the earth. That earth is no different than that basketball, that sphere, or that mansion. How did it get there? Who brought it? That earth is contingent upon something. Something had to put it there. And so it was. So go back to our definition. That which exists is caused either by the necessity of its own nature or an outside agent. Reason and experience convince us of this principle of contingency. Now the next premise is the universe exists. Wow, complicated. Isn't that complicated? Amazing how philosophers will argue this. A philosopher will go, well, what do you mean by universe? And then what do you mean by existing? We're going to stick with Descartes. We're going to say, okay, I think, therefore I am, I exist. Okay, we can start from there. And because I can think and I can exist, I can know that that which around me I experience also exists, therefore the universe exists. This is not arguable in any type of reasonable way. So that's the premise, though, we have to establish. Next, the universe has an explanation for its existence. Now that goes back to contingency. It goes back to our definition of contingency. If the universe exists, then it has an explanation. Something caused it. Something put it there. It was contingent upon some other agent coming in and determining how it would be, the universe. Next premise. The universe, where am I at? The universe was not caused by the necessity of its own nature. Okay, that's the next premise. Not caused by the necessity of its own nature. It doesn't necessarily exist. The universe doesn't have to exist. It cannot exist. I mean, we could have a different universe, and this one not exist. The globe, our Earth, does not have to exist. There's no evidence for it to need to exist. Next premise. The outside agent must transcend that which exists. So if I'm going to say that someone brought in a basketball, and that basketball is contingent on someone bringing it in, that which brought it in has to be greater than the basketball itself. A human being has to bring it in. The sphere is the same way. The mansion is the same way. Because that agent is dependent on another agent, that other agent it's dependent upon has to be greater. And that leads us to the final conclusion. Sorry, two more. The only agent that transcends the universe is God. So we need a bigger, a larger agent, a greater agent. The only thing that's greater than that transcends the universe is God. Premise: the universe was created by God. You might think that's a conclusion, but again, what are we after? God exists. Therefore, God exists. If one thing is dependent upon another thing, you have to bring about the conclusion that it leads back all the way to the idea that God exists. And because God exists, He is the only one that can create the universe, and He is one that transcends the universe, and we recognize that the universe is not caused by its own nature, and the universe has an explanation for its existence, and it exists. And again, it all comes back to based on the fact that God exists. Now, this is interesting in that it actually follows some rules of logic. And if you haven't taken logic, I don't want to worry too much with this. But an atheist will say that the universe doesn't need an explanation for its existence. The universe doesn't have an explanation for its existence. In fact, Bertrand Russell, a well-known atheist, said, "The universe just is, and that's all." Meaning that it has no need for an explanation. But if you write that out into a logical equation, it says this: if God does not exist, then the universe has no explanation. We're going to write this in a symbolic form. If not Q, then not P. If God does not exist, then the universe has no explanation. Now, if you, again, no logic at all, you can recognize that there is a switcheroo that can take place that is equivalent. If we say that God does not exist, therefore there's no explanation for the universe, we can actually, by rule of transposition, say, if P, then Q. God exists, therefore there is an explanation for the universe. To say this is actually saying this. And of course that is our position. We can also put it in a modus ponens. If the universe exists, then the explanation for its existence is God. The universe exists, therefore its cause is God. And that's equivalent to, if God does not exist, then the universe has no explanation. God does not exist, the universe has no explanation. Of course, that's absurd. Because if you're going to say that God does not exist and the universe has no explanation, then you're saying that something can pop into being out of nothing. Something can pop into being out of nothing. And, of course, that doesn't happen in our experience. Things have a cause. And so when we look at this, we say, what's more plausible? What's more reasonable? Do we conclude that God exists and therefore was the active agent that brought about the universe? Or do we say that the universe just is or popped into being with no needed or available explanation? Again, what is more plausible? What is more reasonable? And that's what we're after. Are we reasonable? Now, a question begs itself, and if you've heard of Richard Dawkins, this is one of his retorts to this. He says, if you're going to follow this line of logic, then you can't explain God's existence, because something had to cause God. But go back to our first premise. Our first premise was, that which exists is caused either by the necessity of its own nature or by an outside agent. God is caused by the necessity of his own nature. God has to exist. He doesn't need, he's not contingent upon anybody. If you are all-powerful and all-knowing, why do you need anything else but yourself? But the reason why we struggle with this, and even why these men who get great podiums and great money for their books get so much attention, is because they, like us, are under the sun. They are restricted by time, and we can only think about the world in terms of time. And so when we think about what existed before God, we say, well, there has to be an answer, because we understand the world in terms of time. But God, as we know in Genesis, created time. In order to create time, you have to stand above time and not be limited by it. And therefore, we don't have to, God doesn't have to explain to us how he exists outside of time. And how could there be something before him when he is all that there is and not restricted by time? All right, we move on. The next argument is known as the cosmological argument. Cosmological argument. Cosmos. Universe. First premise. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. Yeah, that's pretty straightforward. Very similar to our contingency argument. That which exists has a cause. It's a metaphysical scientific proof that being cannot come from non-being. Being cannot come from non-being. Things can't just pop into being. In fact, it's been argued that if things could pop into being, like the universe just popping into being, and the earth just popping into being, well, why doesn't that happen more often? Why can't you just all of a sudden there be a horse pop into this room? Why can't there be a slurpee machine pop in here because I'm thirsty? Think of all the things that could possibly happen if this idea of being coming from non-being actually was real. But of course, that's not how our existence works. And it's, again, metaphysically proven. Being does not come from non-being. The next premise, the universe began to exist. Now that's not just saying the universe exists, it's saying the universe began to exist. It had a beginning point. And this is highly debatable. Highly debatable. But I want you to understand that it actually goes back to St. Thomas Aquinas' arguments, his five ways for the existence of God. He talks about his first three ways. He uses this same principle, that there has to be a beginning point. If there's movement, then there had to be a prime mover. Someone had to start the thing. And he argued that you cannot go back into infinity. That's impossible. Now, where philosophers have, they believe, have cut Aquinas' argument is they say, why not? Why can't you go back to infinity? Mathematicians use it. Why can't we? Well, there is a reason. So I put under here, under premises, and you might not be able to see these, but I will read them. Under this premise, we have under premises. Under premise, the first one, an actual infinite number of things cannot exist. An actual, and underline actual, an actual infinite number of things cannot exist. Point number two, or under premise two, the beginningless series of past events involves an infinite number of things. So if you're going to say that the universe doesn't have a beginning, then it has to have an infinite number of things. But we just said premise number one, that an infinite number of things actually doesn't exist. Therefore, a beginning series of past events cannot exist. The universe had to have a beginning. Now, in order to stand on this argument, this under-argument for the second premise, you have to be careful to differentiate between what is called potential infinite and actual infinite. Potential infinite and actual infinite. Potential is used in theory. Pythagoras used the idea of potential infinite. And he tried to explain the world and its existence in terms of divides or numbers, and that he believed that everything could be divided to an infinite degree. So he believes that you could take a table like this, and you can cut it in half, you cut it in quarters, and then you cut it in eighths, and you can keep going 16, 30 seconds, and you can keep going to infinity. That was his argument. And interestingly, a man by the name of Zeno came along, and he introduced the argument reductio ad absurdum, which is to say that if you were to take Pythagoras' position to its logical conclusion, then movement would be impossible. If you were able to divide everything to an infinite degree, then the old story of the tortoise and the hare, if the hare ever got in front of the tortoise, the tortoise could never catch him. Because he would have to pass an infinite amount of space in order to get there. Which means that he would never catch up. Because it's infinity. It never ends. But of course, what they were arguing was potential versus actual. And when we talk about the existence of the infinite, we're talking about that which is actual. That there is no actual infinity. Let me show you this on a number line. Let's say that we had a number line. It went 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and then on into infinity. Okay? That's our number line. Now, in this number line, if we were to take away all of the even numbers, take away 2, take away 4, take away 6, take away 8, take away 10. Now, we can still go on with odd numbers to infinity, can we not? And we just got rid of all the even numbers, but we're still able to go on into infinity. So, what we just did is wrote an equation that says infinity minus infinity is what? Infinity. That doesn't make any sense. That's contradictory. Proving that infinity cannot actually exist. Another example. Let's say that we had a number line again. And let's say that we're going to get rid of... we have a number line to infinity. And we're going to get rid of all the numbers, real numbers, from 4 to infinity. Okay? So let's get rid of them all. So we had... Here's our equation. Infinity minus 4 onward is infinity. Infinity minus infinity is 3. Right? That's what we just did. But that's contradictory. That's silly. What we're showing is you cannot actually have the number infinity. Potentially, yes. In theory, yes. But not in actuality. And so, when we go back to our premises, we said, whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, had a beginning point. And then we come to our conclusion. God is the most plausible cause of the existence of the universe. So it had to have a beginning point. It can't go back forever. And therefore, as Aquinas argued, there has to be a prime mover, a first mover, and the only answer for that is God. Any questions on that? Right, we're coming to the last argument. The last one is called the teleological argument. And the teleological argument is one of the more important ones in my perspective, because it deals with purpose. It deals with why we exist, rather than the fact that we just exist, that there is proof that there's a purpose behind our existence. Bump this up there. Okay. Teleos refers to purpose. The first premise: the fine-tuning of the universe is either caused by law, chance, or design. Only three options. Now, when we talk about fine-tuning, we talk about how perfect the Earth is in relationship to the universe and is able to have spawn life. When you talk about the exact distance the Earth has to be from the sun in order not to be fried on one side, or in order not to be too cool for life on another, we talk about the tilt of the Earth and how that tilt causes seasons. We talk about the gravitational pull of the Earth and how necessary it is because we are spinning on our axis, and if we didn't have gravity, we'd fly off. And if we'd have too much gravity, we'd be smashed. And how fast we are moving through the universe around the sun, and how gravity keeps us on this Earth, and how the necessity of that spinning in order to keep, and yet the fact that we're able to stand and have peace of mind and a calm moment, that all this fine tuning, there's more to it than that, but that gives you an idea. So the fine tuning of the universe is either caused by law, chance, or design. Let's look at each of these. If we look at law, laws of nature, they do not. Laws of nature do not fine-tune anything. Laws of nature do not fine-tune anything. When we talk about laws of nature, we're talking about things like the law of gravity, the things that Isaac Newton discovered when it comes to gravitation, laws of motion, and so on. But this premise is arguing is that if you're going to accept the opposite, then you're saying that physical necessity of laws is used to create, that the physical laws are necessary in order to create, but there's no evidence for that. If there's a physical necessity for creation, there's no evidence to that. Nature does not show us how it has laws that can create anything. They govern, but they don't create. So if a person is going to take this stand that no, the laws of nature do create, there's no physical evidence for that whatsoever. And so we get rid of that, and we go to the next one. The chance probabilities are too great to consider reasonable. Now this is going to be argued to a greater, more specific extent when we talk tomorrow. I'm not going to be doing that, but you'll get it, and you'll see the probabilities are so diminished that the Earth could be the way it is just by chance, just by the right things at the right time coming together, that the probabilities are so small that it is unreasonable to believe that we came here and the Earth is the way it is, the universe is the way it is, by chance. The conclusion then. The fine-tuning is not caused... Excuse me.
That should be the next premise.
I had something different on my notes. That's fine. Conclusion. The fine-tuning of the universe is caused by God. It just goes to say that we said it's either one of these three. These two are eliminated. Therefore, it must be caused by design. Now, instead of embracing the idea of a designer, what does our secular world argue? What is their answer for the earth being the way it is, for humans being the way they are, for all of creation being the way it is? What's their answer?
Big Bang
Theory. Okay, well, let's not get there, because there's people who are creationists who believe in the Big Bang. So, evolution, right? That's their answer. Evolution is what they believe is an answer for how creatures exist on this earth. Is evolution reasonable? Think about it this way. Now, Christians talk in terms of, as creation scientists talk in terms of macro evolution versus micro. Micro. Micro is the idea that species in and of themselves can evolve over time. They might be able to lose a tail or develop longer claws. Over time, create the way that they breed, different aspects of them that are better suited for the environment in which they are. But they never, this is the argument, jump from one species to another. They evolve within their species. But the macro, would some use, the secular scientists prefer super macro. So we'll use that. But what we're challenging is the idea of a super macro evolution. Does that exist? Now consider, again, we're talking about probability. We're talking about whether something is truly even possible. The Earth is said, and we're going purely by modern science right now, the Earth is said to be over 13 billion years old. Okay? That's what modern scientists will say. 13 billion years old. The evolution of man, they say, is identifiable at 6 million years ago. 6 million years ago. So we're talking a very short time compared to the time that the Earth was, they believe, was came into being, to when man came into being and then developed as he is now, Homo sapiens. So the consideration that you have to come about is, what evidence is there to show us how man evolved to what we are now? Because you recognize that the theory of evolution says that every created being, creature or human, comes from one source. One source. That primordial ooze that created somehow life, and then a creature crawled out of it and was able to sustain life, and then developed and grew into all sorts of different types of creatures and species. That's what they're saying. And it was Michael Denton, a molecular biologist, he makes this point in terms of considering a bat and a whale. Okay? I'm going to draw a bat. This is my bat. He's got wings. That's my bat. Okay, and here's a whale. Okay? Hold that. And here's the primordial ooze. Okay, we'll talk about crawling out of the water. You have to consider how many millions of species are involved in that they were able to create this and that from one particular species. How many millions are required? Now you might say, well, you know, 13 billion, 6 million, finally get to man. Yeah, maybe that can happen. But here's the thing. There are no fossil records that show us anything in regards to how this line occurred and this line occurred. You would think, over that many years, that there would be millions of evidences. The fossil records, you'd be tripping over them all of the time. But they're not there. They're not there. If you're going to make that claim, is this reasonable to make that claim? That all this complicated creature and this complicated creature all come from one particular creature, and yet there's no evidence, fossil records, again, thinking that there would have to be more than millions to show how this evolved? Nothing. Again, I've been asking you to consider whether the Christian faith is reasonable. And I believe it is. When examining any argument, the premise of an argument must be more plausible than their negations. The premises of an argument must be more plausible than their negations. We're arguing from plausibility. And all of these ways in which we've approached the existence of God, and God being the answer for creation, are our arguments, our premises, more plausible than their negations? Re-examine them. On the question of cause for the universe and life on earth, the most plausible answer is God. I really liked an example or a description William Lane Craig gave when he was talking about why people who seem so bright, who seem so willing to study and to find answers, will believe in something like this as plausible as opposed to the arguments we just gave for the existence of God. And he described the reason like this. He said, people reject premises primarily because they don't like to where the conclusion is leading. And so they want to stop the argument. And he says that skeptics dial their... each person has a skeptical dial, and those who are truly skeptical dial that dial way up when it comes to a conclusion they don't like, and dial it way down when it comes to a conclusion that they really like. So they'll be more hard on the Christian arguments and less difficult upon their own. And even though that's true, what I'm trying to say to you is it ought not be that way for Christians. We shouldn't be dialing it way up here, bring it back down when it comes to theirs. We should be willing to face the hard truths of difficult arguments against our position and find answers to show that, yes, our faith is indeed reasonable. People of faith can most certainly be reasonable, and I believe that we should be reasonable. All right, that ends my talk. Are there any questions that have been generated? Alright. Well, what we're going to do now, and if you do have questions, we're going to have a question and answer time, you see, tomorrow. You can even stop us if you'd like to sometime during the day or tonight. But feel free to ask questions, or if you find some loopholes or problems with an argument, feel free to ask. What we're going to do now is we're going to go downstairs. There's some refreshments to grab, and then we're going to have some games in the gym. So make your way downstairs and grab some refreshments before we go into the gym.